Oh, of course. If you have heard that song, as I have many, many times before, you know it's Ron Carter on bass with All Blues. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. And today, because of the way the week broke, we'll catch up. We have to catch up on the news. Because it broke kind of funny, especially considering the assignment that we really most wanted to cover. But we're here today with our colleague, Kim Ives, a journalist and documentarian and editor of the Haiti Liberté Newsweekly. He's here with us to report on the mood of the nation after the funeral of assassinated President Jovenel Moïse and what the future, the immediate future especially, of Haiti is shaping up to be. Kim, I'm glad that you were able to come back safely and soundly. And to join us to talk about this rather depressing story, but intriguing just the same, and something we ought to have an understanding of. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you very much, Eutrice. I'm glad to be with you as always.
Well, you went to the funeral, and that means that you were able to absorb a bit of the character of the nation at the time that you got there. What was it like?
Well, no, unfortunately, I left Haiti before the funeral took place.
Oh.
But I did get a feel for the country, and I watched the funeral on YouTube, which was, of course, almost all the events in Haiti now are being streamed live somewhere or another. The mood of the country is one of trauma. People on both sides of the Jovenel Moïse question are shocked by the way he was machine gunned in his house by foreign mercenaries, Colombians. This is creating almost a sense of people being dazed. As we speak, there is a big march going on in Pont Rouge, which is sort of a edge of Cité Soleil. That's the spot where Haiti's founding father, Jean-Jacques Dessalines, was killed in 1806. And really, since then, it has been a very tumultuous battle between the different factions of the Haitian ruling class, with several presidents being killed along the way. But Jovenel Moïse is just the latest. And that march is organized by, I could say, the organization of the lumpen proletariat in Haiti, what's called the Revolutionary Forces of the G9 family and allies, headed by a fellow called Jimmy Cherizier Barbecue, is his nickname. And they are asking people to come out and wear white and bring candles or whatever to commemorate the president's passing. And it's interesting in his call for that to happen. He said, "This doesn't matter which side you were, if you were for Moïse or against him, but the way he was taken out in this absolutely horrific crime cannot happen, should not happen here, and we can't let it go like that." Essentially, Eutrice, the battle between Jovenel Moïse and his former bourgeois sponsors, in particular a fellow called Reginald Bulos and others, has become very bitter. And we at Haiti Liberté are very suspicious that somebody like Reginald Bouloss or maybe a consortium of other bourgeois, including Dimitri Vorbe, who was also at odds with him, and others which we might not even know, may have contributed to a sort of fund to carry out this operation, which cost at the very least close to $1 million. You had about almost 30 mercenaries at $3,000 a month, it said, with lodgings and vehicles and telephones. And this was over the course of 3 or 4 months leading up to the assassination on the in the early morning hours of July 7th. And essentially, to review for listeners who may not be following this closely, the band of mercenaries with two Haitian Americans in tow, who were acting as supposedly as translators, came up the road to Jovenel Moïse's private residence, announcing over loudspeaker that they were the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Agency of the U.S. government, which has some sort of supranational weight in Latin America and in Haiti in particular. They said, "We are going to, we will not hurt you if you come out with your hands up." And apparently there was no fight with Jovenel Moïse's security. We are told that he had three guards at his private residence in the mountain community of Pellerin, which is just above Pétionville. Very mountainous, very difficult to reach, but they came up, they rolled up past several police checkpoints. Apparently they were cleared through. Investigation is going into how that happened. And they came into the house. According to the testimony of Martine Moïse, his wife, they hid their kids in the bathroom. They hid under the bed in their room. The mercenaries came in. They pulled her out first, shot her three times, once in the arm, twice in the leg. And then they pulled him out from under the bed. Apparently, they were speaking into a cell phone, getting directions. They described him. Tall, thin, black, and the person on the other end of the phone said, "Yeah, kill him." And they did. They shot him between 12 and 16 times, shot out his eye. His body was riddled. Bones were broken. It was very grisly. The photos of the autopsy photos of the body went out online, were viewed by Haitians everywhere, as well as the x-rays. And Martine Moïse was transported to a hospital in Miami, where she recovered after 10 days, 2 weeks, and has returned to Haiti, where the funeral was held on this past Friday. So this all came about because of the battle that occurred between Jovenel Moïse and the bourgeoisie, which had sponsored him in 2016 to become the candidate of the PHTK, a party founded by Michel Martelly, a ribald compas singer, back in 2010-11. And the Martelly government from 2011 to 2016 had kind of a joyride because they had about $2 billion from a solidarity fund established by Venezuela from the sale of cheap Petrocaribe fuel. That was the name of the fund, Petrocaribe, set up by Hugo Chavez, where Haiti would get about 20,000 barrels a day. But that all came to an end in 2017 because Donald Trump slapped his stiffer sanctions on Venezuela and they could no longer keep the fuel flowing. So when the money stopped, the party stopped, and Jovenel Moïse, who the bourgeoisie had hoisted in as they thought a reliable puppet to carry on their interests, said to the bourgeoisie, listen, you guys have to ante up some money because we're not getting Petrocaribe anymore and all the wonderful things that I said I'd do. You know, I need money to do it. So they immediately turned on him, tried to back demonstrations to kick him out, and a war started. And so this is what we believe is behind the killing. Investigations are going on. The FBI is in the country. The Colombian intelligence service is in the country. Now the Ecuadorians are apparently helping. And this is because there were a number of people, but in particular one, a guy called Dimitri Herard, who was the head of the palace guard, supposedly guarding Jovenel Moise, who was going back and forth to Colombia and Ecuador. It's a very complex plot. We're not sure, who the ultimate intellectual authors and financiers of this plot are, but it's looking like they have a lot of front men, a lot of patsies or fall men who are presently falling. There's one in particular, a pastor slash doctor from Florida, a guy called Christian Emmanuel Sano, who has been taken into custody. He apparently hired the mercenary firm that provided the mercenaries in Miami, even though most of the Colombians came from Colombia and were former Colombian soldiers, many of them trained at the School of the Americas in Fort Benning, Georgia. And but clearly he was not the real guy behind this because he was basically bankrupt, a very marginal figure. So, you know, these are just like Lee Harvey Oswald in the Kennedy killing back in 1963 is probably just the guy they're going to try to pin it on. But so the investigation is ongoing, both by the law enforcement authorities and I think by all investigative journalists working around Haiti, like ourselves at Haiti Liberté, into who did this, who was behind this, who put together this huge operation. And the last thing I'll say about this all, Utrice, is that there's no possibility that the U.S. government was not aware this was going down. I mean, with so many people involved in Haiti for so long, and you have the fourth largest U.S. embassy in the world in Haiti. It's bristling with antennas. They're covering every electron that moves in the country, into and out of it. We feel that there's no possible way they didn't have a good idea of who's in, and don't have a good idea today who was behind this and how it was going to go down and what was likely to happen, which was the assassination of a Haitian president once again. So that's kind of the wrap-up I can give at this moment.
How many other levels of investigation do you think might be necessary to get close to definitive answers about who was involved and why?
Well, it's going to be very hard because clearly these people are quite ruthless. I mean, when you can come in and just machine gun a president in his bedroom and, you know, waltz away. So getting people to squeal on them is not going to be an easy matter. On the other hand, they have clearly some vulnerabilities because these mercenaries who carried this out have basically been caught, most of them. There are five, I think, still on the run. And the whole hit team was kind of a plot within a plot, it seems. It seems there were seven of the Colombians who were aware of the real mission, which was to kill Jovenel Moise. But it appears that the other 11 of them, because there were 18 Colombians involved so far, as we know, maybe the other five are also Colombian. But it seems there was a sort of outer ring of mercenaries who thought they were in Haiti to guard an important person. They thought they were bodyguards. So The whole thing is complex with that in that respect. But the fact that these guys were caught because they, after carrying out this heinous crime, they ended up just kind of driving down the hill and were basically barricaded by the police. And after a siege, three of them were killed and the others were captured after they fled and hid for a while in the embassy of Taiwan. Taiwan is not really a country, as your listeners may know. It is a renegade province of China, but they do have a quote-unquote embassy in Haiti because Haiti is one of the 16 countries left in the world who recognize them as a sovereign state of China. But the mercenaries were all captured. But, you know, why and how? I mean, anybody with a slightest lick of military knowledge knows that you leave a different way than you came. But they just drove down the hill, got caught. Now, was that because they thought they were going to be carried away on the shoulders of the Haitian people for getting rid of the dictator? Or was it because they were just stupid? Or was it because they were betrayed? We don't know yet. We're still looking into that. But all this means that if it was option number two and they were just dumb about it, maybe there's going to be other areas where they were stupid and we can pick up a trace and follow a trail. But for sure, you know, really to get to the bottom of it, to find out who was behind it is going to require somebody within, a source within the operation to spill the beans. And in Haiti, one of the poorest countries in the Western Hemisphere because of its victimization and bullying by the U.S. primarily, somebody like Reginald Bulos or any of the other bourgeois who might be behind this, they have a lot of money and therefore a lot of impunity in Haiti. So it's going to be a real task, and we don't quite know yet where the break will come. But, you know, people are very, very anxious to understand this. Above all, one thing I should say, just as I close this little part, is that, you know, Jovenel was quite besieged in the capital, Port-au-Prince, by demonstrations almost weekly in 2019, became almost monthly in 2020 during the COVID crisis, and they were picking up in 2021, especially after he overstayed his mandate by not stepping down on February 7th, 2021, as constitutionally he was supposed to do. But in the countryside of Haiti, he did many projects in Jeremy. You know, he built an airport or fixed up the airport, repaved the road to the airport, repaved all the roads in the town, electrified the town. It had 2 hours of electricity a week before. Now it has 20 hours a day. He did similar projects up in Port-au-Paix, which was his wife's hometown, in the north, in Trou-du-Nord, his hometown, in Wanamant. He was near Wanamant. He was building a dam, which was going to provide jobs. It was taking water from the Dominican Republic, the river that runs between the Dominican Republic and Haiti, and the Dominicans were unhappy about it. So he was doing many things that people, and also on the Central Plateau, he did projects. So a lot of people in the Haitian countryside really liked him. He was very popular in the countryside. But so this has created kind of a churning, disgruntlement and anger in the country. And as I say, there is this march today in Port-au-Prince, which is sort of honoring his passing, as embattled as he was. And so all of this is to say, Utrice, to your question, how will we get to the truth in this? We don't know yet, but we're just trying every doorknob, every door to see, you know, where we might find a clue.
Well, you've had a chance to get a sense because you were you've been following this story in a way long before Jovenel was assassinated. What does the immediate future of Haiti, what is it shaping up to be from your perspective?
Well, I think we are in a period of real transition. I think that really this, I wrote a piece for a magazine called Rupture Online back in early 2020, which was saying Haiti was on the cusp of a revolution. And in that past year, there was, of course, the COVID epidemic, which sort of put everything in a deep freeze. And that's not just in Haiti, but worldwide. If people recall, at the end of 2019, the world was basically standing up and demonstrations were seething across the planet. But in Haiti, in 2020, there emerged, as I say, this movement out of Haiti's shantytowns. Again, Haiti was 40 years ago, when the Duvalier regime was still in place, a mostly agricultural country. It was small peasant farmers working in the countryside. The Haiti was largely feeding itself in terms of rice and other products. But all that was really crushed under the weight of neoliberal reforms, which were championed by administrations, both Republican and Democrat, in the U.S. And this destroyed Haitian agriculture, and thousands of farmers were driven off the land and into the cities. Port-au-Prince ballooned from a city of about 500,000 to over 3 million today. And most of these people don't have jobs. They don't have regular jobs. You know, they might try to make a living hawking soda or chiclets or sugar cane on the street, but they are on the edge of starvation. So you have this huge lumpen proletariat, as Marx and Engels called them, of the underclass, the class underneath the working class who has no employment. And what has emerged in the shanty towns are gangs. I mean, they're called gangs by the U.S. press, but in many cases, they're neighborhood organizations. But even this is complex because some of these gangs turn towards criminality, as many in the lumpen proletariat do. Marx and Engels called it the dangerous class. And they have been involved in kidnapping and extortion and other terrible crimes, rape. But there is another part of the gangs which has said, no, you know, we have to bring improvement, and we need schools, hospitals, internet, sanitation, water, and things to raise our people up out of the mud and sewage and misery in which they live. And those two sectors of the gangs are sort of have been battling each other, but the gangs the armed neighborhood organizations of this lumpen proletariat who are trying to beat back crime have been saying to all the gangs, including the ones they're fighting, please, let's not fight each other, let's not spill each other's blood. Let's unite together against the bourgeoisie who has put these guns in our hands, and let's change what they call this stinking rotten system that is putting us in this terrible state. And they've even said, you know, we're going to take your grocery stores, your car dealerships, your banks, and, you know, change this. So you have this boiling up, churning up from the bottom, this huge push, to have a revolution in Haiti. And I think this may play a huge role, Utrice, in the assassination of Jovenel Moïse, because he was in a rivalry or a feud, we could say, with the bourgeoisie that put him in power. But I think their real fear is that underclass, that lumpen proletariat, which is armed and angry and on the move. And I think so. We are going to see an extremely turbulent 2021, or I should say, second half of 2021, even more turbulent than what we've seen up until now.
Well, we'll get into a deeper conversation. I know that you have a lot of reporting to do, but I'm glad that you were able to spare us about a half hour today to bring us up to snuff and to do so with angles that we did not hear about before. So I'm looking forward to us continuing the conversation, and I thank you for sacrificing some very precious time today to talk to us. Thanks so much, Kim, for being with us today.
Well, thank you, Eutrice. I don't see it as a sacrifice. I always see it as an investment in speaking to your listeners.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, we'll take this break, and when we come back, we'll talk about the Biden takedown that has begun right after this. You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.fm. I'm Eutrice Lead. And after that briefing, it's amazing that he calls it a briefing, because that was quite a bit of information to analyze and to present within just a half hour. Well, we come to you and what you're thinking, because in my view, the Biden takedown has begun. Trump's attack dogs are casting doubt about Biden's health as an advanced age, at an advanced age as he is at 75, making it sound so ancient. But he's just 3 years older than Donald Trump. And showing signs, they said, of diminished mental acuity. What is beginning to happen in your view? What is all of this about? The sudden pouncing on Joe Biden and his supposed super aging. He's super aging. He's not just aging, he's super aging and falling apart. And right behind that kind of talk will be the question of he's got to go. He cannot stay in office much longer because he'll be a danger to the country. 888-874-4888 is the number to call. I'm interested in whether you're noticing a kind of theme emerging in the discussions about Joe Biden. In fact, a physician with the United States government has already said he expects Biden to resign. Of course, Biden is not resigning, not yet, but there's this push now, and the campaign has begun to hit this point, to drive it home time and again, so people begin to look at Joe Biden as a defective man who by no means should remain in office. Max from New York, what do you think this is all about?
Yes, Latrice, thank you for taking my call.
Thank you for calling.
I would like, if possibly, make a comment on the previous subject concerning the Haitian, the assassination of the Haitian leader.
Okay, but generally, I like us to stick to the topic. But go ahead.
Okay, I find that the leaders these days that are being taken down, or anyone, any leader that is going against a central bank, and going against marijuana, legalization of marijuana, and going against anything that is LGBT. They are taken out either by the press or, in the case of the Haitian president, by a bullet.
Okay, you made your statement. Now let's talk about what you're thinking with this is there a shift? Are you sensing a revving up of a campaign against
Biden?
Joe Biden. Yes.
Yes. Okay, this is going on for some time, and the press has taken out a famous video of President Biden confessing about when he had his brain surgery, that they actually sawed off the top of his head and did the medical work and then placed it back on top. And ever since then, he really has not been that sharp since that point. The media has been covering up for him, and Donald Trump right now is taking advantage of this situation of his decline, not to mention the voter fraud that took place that I'm sure will be the next subject of Donald Trump's maligning of Joe, which I would say is not, I mean, so much maligning as it is maybe justified. I don't know if you'll agree with that.
Oh, no, I'm listening. I'm not agreeing or disagreeing today. I'm listening today.
All right. So that, I guess that would be my statement.
Okay. Thank you so much for your call. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Latrice.
888-874-4888. Are you sensing a decided shift in the way Biden is being treated, the way the media are expected to cover him now? And the theme has been established that Biden is a sick guy. He's certainly too old to be in office, and he's losing it. You need a much younger guy, 3 years younger, named Donald Trump, to come along and fix things. And he has everything that Biden is losing. And so they're priming the country for an acceptance of the suggestion that Biden ought to be forced out of office. Gwen from New York, you're on the air.
Oh, hi, Utrice.
Hi.
Hi. This damn phone. I haven't seen anything on TV about this, or actually even heard anything. I mean, I've been hearing
you too well. I cannot hear you.
Oh, sorry. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay. Yes, I was saying I haven't heard anything on TV or the radio about Biden, but I have heard about Trump saying that August is going to be his time to try to come back in and seize power again. Now, I don't have cable TV, so that's probably why I haven't heard anything. But I still think that Trump's going to have a hard time because he's not the younger candidate. He's 3 years younger. And if it's true that Biden had this operation, I mean, he's pretty sharp to me for somebody who's, you know, for that kind of operation. I think he's pretty sharp. And I also think there's enough people around him that are, if something is not, you know, well, first of all, I think that the Biden presidency has been a mix of voices, which I'm happy about. I don't think that he's one of these egomaniacs that stands up there and says, I know all the answers. I really don't think he does that. And I think it's really good to have somebody that's willing to hear other people bring their opinions and their knowledge to the table. I mean, it's just much more, what do we say? Oh, it's democratic. So I think that is kind of one star I would give him for that, that you will never see with Donald Trump, because Donald Trump is a fascist egomaniac who doesn't want any other voices at the table. So, you know, before we jump the gun and say, you know, that gloom and doom and the Joe Biden is on his way out, I don't think he's on his way out at all. I don't think that people are willing to be traumatized like this anymore. And I think that this global warming, this huge, tremendous surge of rain that we've been seeing and drought and fires, you know, Donald Trump is the person who's been telling you that's not happening. That's not real. So I don't really know what the selling point is if you want to bring him back, because he was a person who helped bring global warming on even more rapidly and more extreme. He accelerated it. He wanted to do that. He can't say he did anything with the virus because he's on exactly the same page. He never, you know, he never told you not to take your vaccine when it came out. He wanted to collect credit for giving people the vaccine. So he's on this, he's on the same page as that. There's really nothing that's clearly different enough about him to make anyone want him to be the president who's sane. But there are the people that have their bitter feelings about him not being able to take a dictatorship of our country. And yeah, they're going to be out there again. And that's about a third of the public, I would say, or maybe a little bit more. And I, actually, I'm going to say only a third, because I think the people that did vote for him before the first time, I'm pretty sure that they stood back in horror as they watched what he did. And they would not put that vote forth.
Do you appreciate, though, a difference or a mounting difference in tone in the coverage of Biden and in the attitude toward Biden, which is how these campaigns begin?
Start, yeah. Well, like I said, I'm kind of embarrassed to tell you that I haven't seen anything. I mean, I watch the 6:30 news, Lester Holt. I watch ABC. These are both, you know, world news. I haven't heard anything that sounded disparaging about the president in those places. I listen to WBAI and this station, and I haven't really heard anything covered here. However, I would guess that it's being heard on CNN and Fox and CNBC, and none of those stations I have, so I can't really weigh in on the conversation that way. But I still think they're going to have a really big push to try to make a bridge to have people say, oh yeah, it's so bad. It's not so bad. It's almost exactly the same climate as when Trump was here, with little places of hope, where Biden has been much better for regular people than Trump was. So I don't think that the extremists who love Trump are going anywhere soon. I feel that they'll try to mount a campaign in order to create another coup d'etat, and I take them very seriously. That I think they would do.
All right.
But that I'll leave it there.
All right. Thank you for contributing today. 888-874-4888. The question being posed today is, do you sense a shift coming or a shift already happening in the way Trump is positioning his contest against Biden, showing Biden to be feeble-minded, way too old for office, and presumably he's setting up an argument for a little bit later. Ed from Queens, you're on the air.
Good afternoon, you three. How are you?
Okay, Ed. Thank you. How are you doing?
Well, you know, me and my thumbs still here.
still hanging from your thumbs.
Still here. Pertaining to President Biden, I'm not so much concerned with Trump. I mean, Trump is basically grasping at straws, and he'll, anything that he sees as being advantageous, he'll try to abuse or propagate to his advantage. That being said, Biden is showing signs of weakness. He hasn't been able to live up to his campaign promises. The fight for 15 was non-existent. The climate bill, he's bartering away too much. And if he doesn't, or if the Democrats as a party and Biden as the titular head of the party can't pull off enough of the promises that they had, I believe a lot of people, especially young people that I've spoken to personally, are going to become disaffected and not going to vote. And that could give Trump a window with his diehard Trumpites. And that's what I fear. I don't think the Democratic Party is taking the fight seriously. I don't think they're using the majority as they should. I still think they should get rid of filibuster. And they're not making the moves that the people wanted them to make as far as voting out Trump and voting out the Republican Party. They need to be more assertive, and they're not. They're trying to do too much political compromise, and you don't have to. You have a mandate. Even though it might be a slim mandate, use it. You know, bully your way through. get some things on the table to reassure the people for the midterms that this is the way to go. Because this is the only system that we got.
But in the world of politics, Ed, anything that you could use as a weapon against your opponent is a good thing. What do you think about this angle that they're taking very early on as portraying Biden as a feeble, aging man?
Well, not for nothing, my personal opinion, he is. I mean, he's showing that throughout the course of the campaign. In the beginning when he was behind, his lying, his strange actions with women, his non-sequiturs, his sometimes his inane rambling. I mean, it could be a situation where the last term of Reagan, when Reagan was the president, but he was not of. But we know now that he was suffering from end-stage Alzheimer's, and that Nancy and the rest of those of his cabinet really ran the White House at the very end. So I don't know what state Biden is in. I mean, you know, he's showing signs, my opinion, of not lucidity. And I don't believe that he's got the gusto to pull off the things that we need to do to turn this country around. The climate bill, education, the housing crisis that's coming up, and the fact that whether you believe in COVID or whether you believe in the variant or not, there's something going on that's putting more people in hospitals, younger people, and people of color. So, you know, we don't have time for a weakling or a feeble-minded old man. We got to have somebody that's going to be dynamic and proactive.
Wow. Your scabbard is out. You're looking for blood today. Thanks, Ed. Mm-hmm. Thank you for your very frank assessment. Patricia from New York, you're on the air. What do you think about this tactic? Do you think it's going to pick up speed? Do you think it's going to work? It's going to convince Americans that, yeah, Trump is right. Joe Biden he needs to go to a retirement home.
Good afternoon, you, Teresa, and good afternoon to the PRN family. I'm going to try to piggyback onto Ed, because, you know, there's a saying that even a bad clock is right at least once, you know, every 50 days. So I actually saw this online yesterday, and I thought to myself, now what is this all about? You know, Joe Biden is some people want to call him feeble. Well, he's not the strongest medically. And so to the idea that he might not be able to survive for the next couple of years because of his health, you know, I actually believe that that's probably true. But the issue is not so much whether Biden is feeble or in bad health, because even if he is, as long as he's not dead, as Ed said, and I believe that, it reminds me of the Reagan days when Nancy just, you know, jumped in and made certain that the remainder of his term was carried out well. My concern is that the Democrats who supposedly support that Biden administration, they seem to be clueless. And why do I say that? You know that I try to share the little bit of information that I know with national audiences by calling in on Reverend Sharpton's show. So last week Sunday, I did that. And so I started by saying to Reverend Sharpton, you know, Reverend Sharpton, when the Republicans are the majority party, they're in power. When the Republicans are the minority party, they are in power. What is the Democrats' strategy to address the fact that in the last election, in the 2020 election, the Republicans were able to pick up more black and brown votes? And as a result, Democrats lost seats in the House. Well, and I called back yesterday with the exact same question because he cut me off last week. Well, yesterday he was out of control. I'm dead serious. He called me a Republican operative. He said he didn't understand, you know, why people were calling, advocating on behalf of Republicans. The point I say all of this to say that when you ask Democrats salient, pointed questions, all they want to do is characterize you as an oppositional individual. The problem is they don't have a plan. Joe Biden is the titular head of the party. Joe Biden is not producing on anything that he said, but nobody wants you to ask the question, and nobody wants you to point it out because they don't have a plan.
So is this campaign, though it's in its nascent stage, is it going to be effective against Biden? And therefore, on the other side of the fence, it would suit, it would do a lot to boost Donald Trump.
The narrative is going to continue, because the one thing the Republicans do well is once they construct a narrative, they stick to the story and they just embellish it and they heighten it and they continue it. And so to the extent that they have been successful in the past, I think there will be kinks in the armor. I think they will. The Democrats are going to lose more disaffected people, as Ed pointed out, that very few of the platform that he ran on has he been successful. I know a lot of people feel bad about or upset about the fact that he caved on the $15 minimum wage. That is upsetting folks a lot. Not to mention his position on universal health care, Medicare for all. So, you know, it's not that he was even a strong candidate to begin with. It wasn't so much a Joe Biden candidacy as it was an anti-Trump candidacy. And so the things that he campaigned on, people really believed. And now very little, not even the discussion of the filibuster to address H.R. 1. Is he doing? You know, he's still talking about, well, you know, can't we get along? Can't we all play in the sandbox like nice little boys and girls? Black folks don't want to hear that.
Can't we all play in the sandbox?
Black folks brought him to the prom, and he dumped them right as he got to the prom to dance with somebody else. Yo, I mean, enough already. Black folks have seen this before, but now this is really blatant, like in your face. And see, so when I call in now, Reverend Sharpton, he always knows where I'm going, so he needs to get me off the air real quick.
You are the enemy. You have become the enemy with your theories and your rationales. Thanks, Patricia.
Well, they're not so much theories, because I always ask very pointed, deliberate questions. And again, not only do they not want to hear it, part of the problem is they don't have a plan. Because if you had a plan, you could answer my question.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm concerned that if, in fact, Joe Biden is the figurehead, he is the guy, you've got to get him, you know, to the goalpost. And it looks like he's having a little trouble. And it also looks like he doesn't have very much support. He doesn't have very many people flagging for him and covering for him so that he can get to the goal. It does put in your mind the idea that, well, maybe he's kind of weak. Maybe he's fading a little bit. And that's not a good thing to communicate when you're the head of state.
He's never exuded strength to me from the very beginning. And the people that he has surrounded himself, they're not like the people Trump surrounded himself with. They were unprincipled. They were immoral people. But he didn't surround himself with brilliant people. He surrounded himself with non-Trumpists, but that doesn't equate to being brilliant and being astute and being insightful and being conscious. It just equates to he put nice people in office, that's all.
So do you expect that this campaign, which kind of peeped its cards this week, that it would grow in intensity? And it's just testing the waters to see how people are reacting. And if they get a sense that, you know, there's some agreement out here or people have a general view that he's too soft, that this is the lead-in that Donald Trump needs.
the test for Joe Biden is going to be what he ultimately does with H.R. 1. That's going to be the ultimate test. And if people see that he won't produce for H.R. 1, you know, we all need to have a survival strategy starting in 2022. Because it's going to be 2022 and then 2024.
All right. Well, thank you very much for your analysis today. 888-874-4888. I'm talking about what I spotted over the weekend in particular as a kind of launching of a balloon. And the balloon is to test the mettle of Joe Biden against Donald Trump. They started tackling Biden on the issue of age and seniority and the, you know, the gray matter fading away and Biden losing it. He is not cogent. He is showing the signs of age. In fact, one Republican doctor came out and said blatantly, he expects Biden to resign because he doesn't see how Biden is going to be able to cope with the pressures of the office. And he sees that the more intense the pressure, the more Biden will crack. And so he doesn't see that Biden is going to prevail. He doesn't see it. Well, of course, part of it is the propaganda itself. They have to make Biden, and if they see a little chink in the armor, they're going to magnify it and make it appear that this is the problem, that they've been even hiding the problem. But it's, of course, politics as well. If you can show that your opponent or your would-be opponent is disabled or in some way compromised, especially when it comes to the issue of health. And this is where I thought I saw them going. I thought I saw them beginning to make the case of presenting Biden over and over again. It will take at some point presenting Biden as a feeble-minded guy. He might be nice and he may be charming, but charming and nice are not the things that people are clamoring for. They want leadership. And there you have, right across from Biden, is the guy, the square-jawed, lyingest American there ever has been. What a choice we have. 888-874-4888. We have room for one more question quickly if you get in to tell us what you're thinking about this. Is this a tactic that will work? Do you expect to see an intensification of it? Or do you think that they will back off if people, enough people react about it? 888-874-4888. I don't see anybody, but you have time to ask one question. Whoever it is that might be on the line, we have time to take one more question. Look very carefully at how things are spawned and planned and how they become targeted parts or complete parts of a strategy to break somebody, to break them down, to interfere with their steadiness, or at least what they concede to be their steadiness. This is going to rattle Joe Biden and the people who support him. And at the same time, on the flip side of the coin, it is going to reinforce many people's ideas. And they would say, yes, I'm glad somebody's saying that because that's exactly how I feel. This is how rotten politics in the United States is conducted. So we have to watch out for that. I am predicting that it will intensify. I'm predicting that they're trying to unsteady Joe Biden to make him really panicky that perhaps maybe somebody found out something, that he's being treated for something. I don't know. But this is how it starts, the campaign to annihilate the enemy. Well, if you haven't called, don't bother, because we're out of time. And we'll meet up again tomorrow and continue the conversation. Thanks for listening and contributing today. Bye-bye.